you cast your vote.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Fix-It Fair on Saturday, January 27th, 9:30 a.m. at George Middle School in Portland. The Fix-It Fair helps you learn simple ways to save money and connect with resources. Join your neighbors and talk to the experts about how to spend less and stay healthy. There will be exhibits and hourly workshops on water and energy savings, food and nutrition, neighborhood and community resources, weatherizing your home, transportation, a repair cafe, and much more, with childcare and lunch provided. Again, that's the Fix-It Fair on Saturday, January 27th, 9:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at George Middle School, 10,000 North Burr Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This year, 2018, KBOO is celebrating our 50th anniversary. Throughout 2018, we'll be featuring many of the gems from KBOO's archives on our second stream, available exclusively through KBOO's website, kboo.fm/historystream. We'll feature such speakers as Margaret Mead, Bell Hooks, Dick Gregory, John Trudell, early computer hacker Captain Crunch, and audio coverage of the 1968 Democratic National Convention, as well as much, much more. You can find this stream on our website at kboo.fm/historystream.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 9:01 a.m. And coming up on One Land, Many Voices, an exploration of Israel's attempts to censor the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, followed at 10 by Valley Views, presenting part two of its practical and affordable energy-saving techniques that will help reduce your carbon footprint. We'll finish out that hour with Flashpoints with your host, Dennis Bernstein. And we thank KPFA in Berkeley and the Pacifica Foundation for sharing that with us. Solidarity. Regionally and elsewise. At 11, Pacific Underground talks to Nadia Okomato about her article entitled "Until 3 months ago, I was ashamed of being Asian." We look forward to that. KBOO is your independent source for news and entertainment, and you can become a member of the KBOO Foundation. It's easy. You do it online at kboo.fm. You click on the little maroon rectangle with the yellow letters that spell out the word donate. And now, as promised, here is One Land, Many Voices.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Israel has decided to ban 20 organizations, including Code Pink, in a direct response to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. On our show today, we'll speak with Ariel Gold, co-director of Code Pink, about the ban and about the ongoing incarceration of 16-year-old Ahed Tamimi. Then we'll spend the rest of the hour with political economist Mr. Doug Henwood, as we review Michael Wolff's remarkable book, Fire and Fury, Inside the Trump White House. Wolff's book has provided an insider account of the dramatic and dangerous first months of the Trump presidency and has already become a bestseller. That's coming up in just a moment. We'll be right back. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. In the wake of pop star Lorde's decision to not perform in Israel, a victory for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, Israel has now launched its own boycott list. The state, notorious for establishing apartheid-like conditions for Palestinians, released a list of 20 organizations whose members will be barred from traveling there. But Israel's reputation continues to unravel, especially with the arrest and incarceration of a 16-year-old Palestinian girl named Ahed Al-Tamimi, who hails from a prominent, politically active family. Tamimi's case garnered international attention and activism. Meanwhile, the Israeli government is now considering a law legalizing the death penalty, a bill clearly aimed at Palestinian political prisoners. My guest is Arielle Gold. She is the national co-director of Code Pink, which is one of the 20 organizations barred by Israel. She manages the group's campaigns for Palestinian rights. Welcome to the program, Arielle.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
So I suppose it was only a matter of time before Israel responded to BDS with its own ban. Do you see this first as a clear and direct response to BDS? Is that what Israel says? And what does it actually mean? Does it mean that you, for example, couldn't travel to Israel?
Well, I see this as a clear and direct response to all of the successes that we are having in the struggle for Palestinian rights, and BDS is an incredibly important aspect of that struggle and of the successes that we are having. But the picture is actually a bit larger than that. We could also look at how the Palestinian narrative and what's happening to Palestinians and has been happening since 1948 is now getting a very different media coverage, and the media is really lifting up Palestinian stories much more. And the movement for Palestinian rights, it has been growing exponentially. So this new ban is, it's also part of a larger move of repression that Israel has been undertaking very recently and over the past few years. But just looking alone at what's been happening since Trump's declaration of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, on the ground we are seeing massive crackdowns. You mentioned the arrest of Ahed Tamimi, which is horrifying, and she's facing possibly a decade or more in prison. It was actually four members of her family, four women from her village of Nabi Saleh, that were arrested. We've also seen about 2 weeks ago the arrest of peaceful activist Munther Amira from Bethlehem, and Israel is continuing to hold him without release. This is at the backdrop of the ongoing military court trial of Issa Amro from Hebron on 18 charges. So all around, one of the things that I see is that Israel is becoming more and more desperate to protect their apartheid system and to refuse change while the rest of the world is saying that this ongoing system of racism is unacceptable.
How important is the symbolism of Ahed Tamimi? She was caught on video, basically, you know, hitting, punching, kicking at a very well-armed Israeli soldier. Our TV audience can see that video as we're playing. He, of course, is completely protected by his gear and lethal weaponry, and she is a petite young woman who looks extremely angry. But the video doesn't, of course, show the context under which she lives. She's someone referred to as the sort of new millennial resistance, symbol of Palestinian resistance.
Well, right before that attack that you just showed the video of, where Ahed is, and I say attack, that Ahed's home was attacked by soldiers. But right before that video where she's slapping the soldier, her 15-year-old cousin, Mohammed, had just been shot in the face with a rubber-coated steel bullet, and he had to be taken to the hospital for surgery and placed in a medically induced coma. Thankfully, he has survived, But that's what immediately preceded the soldiers coming onto Ahed's family's property and attempting to enter her home, and then she slapped the soldier. Ahed, part of this idea of being a symbol of the millennial resistance is that Ahed represents this new generation of resistance, which is not afraid of soldiers. You know, essentially this family would rather be imprisoned than continue to live and bring another generation into the imprisonment of the occupation. And
essentially they're a generation that has nothing left to lose.
Well, or you could say they're a generation that has hope that their resistance will be successful and that they are empowered both through their own skill set and abilities, but and also through an international movement that is backing them and lifting up their stories to say, we are going to bring this occupation to an end. And that's really terrifying for the Israeli military. You know, after Ahed's arrest, the things that were said by Israeli leaders are really hard to comprehend. We had an Israeli journalist, a prominent Israeli journalist, who called for Ahed openly, pretty openly, to be raped. It was a very thinly veiled call. Naftali Bennett, the education minister in Israel, said that she should be imprisoned for the rest of her life. And the conversation that was happening in the Israeli public was around saying that she had emasculated these soldiers. You know, how dare she raise an arm to the soldiers? And I would say, how dare these soldiers enter her property and continue to allow the theft of her land, the theft of their water springs, and so on. So it's really something that's turned up on its head in terms of who is the criminal here and who is the victim.
So this, what has happened to this young girl and the sort of symbol that she's become is exactly what the BDS movement has been trying to organize around, right? The BDS movement, which many have argued is really a Palestinian-led movement, but has enabled the diaspora, but just international activists around the world to find a way to contribute to the Palestinian struggle for freedom, has urged a boycott of Israel, divestment from Israel, and sanctions against Israel. How important was the decision by the international pop star Lorde to respect the call for musicians to not travel to Israel, to be part of that cultural boycott?
Lorde's decision to cancel her show in Israel was a major victory for the BDS movement and the movement for Palestinian rights. I mean, it was something that occurred really organically and grassroots. It was two young women from New Zealand, one Jewish and one Palestinian.
Which is where Lorde is from, yeah.
Which is where Lorde is from, who reached out to her and penned an open letter. And then, you know, it became its own, it gathered its own momentum on social media, asking Lorde to look at, is this a place she wants to support it? And she responded that she would look at it. And, you know, again, just as Israel has been so furious at Tamimi, they are infuriated at Lorde's very ethical and moral decision. And a full page ad was taken out in the Washington Post calling her a bigot. This is the most ridiculous thing. Actions of ethics are something that should be applauded.
She basically has become a polarizing figure between Israel and Palestinian pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian movements, which of course can be very difficult for a musician to deal with. And I wonder sort of how people who are approached, you know, next by BDS organizers to boycott will respond, or maybe they might quietly find other reasons to not perform in Israel. Regardless, let's talk about the response by Israel. And we covered on our show the incredible backlash to BDS here in the United States on college campuses, by city governments, and even members of Congress, because somehow boycotting Israel is seen as a racist move, even when the very idea of a boycott is very sort of part of our First Amendment, right? So what do you make of the list by Israel, the list of banned organizations? What does it mean practically for you? You, I understand, will no longer be able to travel to Israel?
Well, I'm somebody that previously has traveled to Palestine once or twice a year. And the reason that I've done that has been to work on the ground hand in hand with the Palestinian activists and families who are struggling there and to build relationships. And so,
and to get there, you have to travel through Tel Aviv?
I do have to travel through either way to get in, whether you come in through the Jordanian border or through Tel Aviv. It's Israel that controls the entry point. So there's no way to enter Palestine without permission from the Israeli government. So it seems with the release of this blacklist that I will no longer be able to travel there. You know, I'm really appalled, but at the same time, I'm not at all surprised. This is an incredibly racist, repressive regime that claims to be the only democracy in the Middle East, but by no means respects people's rights. It's an entirely apartheid state that controls a population and gives them no rights to decision-making power over their own lives. Even for Palestinian citizens of Israel, there are 50 laws of discrimination between Jews and non-Jews. So this wasn't something that surprised me. Recently, Israel had also just approved $72 million to combat BDS. But at the same time, I see this as Israel isolating itself even further. And by doing that, it reveals itself more and more to the outside world for the apartheid state that it is.
The list was essentially drawn up by Gilad Erdan, the Minister of Strategic Affairs, who said that we have shifted from defense to offense. The boycott organizations need to know that Israel will act against them and not allow them to enter its territory. And among the organizations, including yours, of course, Code Pink, is Jewish Voice for Peace, American Friends Service Committee, which is a Quaker organization, and a number of other organizations, not all of them American, in fact, many of them international. So they include some American organizations and a number of international ones, too. Can this, you know, where do you think this will lead? I mean, if the BDS movement gets bigger, is Israel simply going to expand its list? How does that benefit Israel to bar people from coming to Israel? That list may get too big to make it worthwhile.
I think it benefits our movement much more than it benefits Israel. As I said, Israel is revealing itself even more for the repressive apartheid state that it is. And what we expect from this list is a major boon for people joining these blacklisted organizations and joining the movement and joining the struggle. And so while Israel is seeking to divide, you know, by not allowing many of us to go and visit our Palestinian friends, this is also an opportunity to expand the movement. And again, in terms of this not being a surprise, this is nothing new. Since 1948, Israel has been refusing entry and refusing the right to return to Palestinian refugees. And I myself am a Jewish American, and so I have always enjoyed an enormous amount of privilege at being able to enter the country. However, my Palestinian American or Muslim counterparts have never enjoyed that privilege, never arrive at the Tel Aviv airport feeling assured that they will be allowed to enter this country. Israel has for many years denied entry to Muslims and Palestinians around the world, even to visit their own families in Palestine.
Well, Ariel, give out a website for Code Pink.
Sure. You can find us at codepink.org. And we encourage you to sign our petition for Ahed Tamimi, which is codepink.org/freeAhed.
And we'll post a link to both those sites, as well as your article in Forward.com that you just published called Israel Made Itself a Pariah by Barring Me and My Fellow Activists. Ariel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Arielle Gold is the National Co-Director of Code Pink. She manages the organization's campaigns for Palestinian rights. We've been discussing some of the latest news coming out of Israel and the Palestinian territories. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.
صباح الخير يا ولاد عمومنا تفضلوا شرفونا شو بتحب مضيفكم دم عربي ولا دموع من عيوننا بعتقد هيك تأملوا نستقبل من هيك تعقدوا لما تدركموا على غلطة من هيك لبسنا الكوفي البيضة والسودة صاروا تلعب الزمان يلبسوها كموضة مهما تفننوا فيها مهما غيروا بلونها كوفية عربية بتضل عربية حطتنا بدنا إياه ثقافتنا بدنا إياه كرامتنا بدنا إياه كل شي إلنا بدنا إياه ما رح نسكت لن نسمح لن ليك ليك لا بقلن يسرقوا شغلي مش إلهن ما خصن فيه قلدونا بلتبس لبس هالأرض بتكفيهنش طمعانين عالقدس قدس اعرفوا كيف تكونوا بشر قبل ما بتلبسوا كوفي جينا نذكرن مين إحنا وغصب عن أبوهم هي حطتنا من هيك لبسنا الكوفي لأنا وطنية الكوفي كوفي عربي من هيك لبسنا الكوفي هويتنا الأساسية الكوفي كوفي عربي يلا علي الكوفي علولي هالكوفية الكوفي كوفي عربي علوه هلا بلاد الشام كوفية عربية بتضل عربي ما في بعد مثل الشعب العربي فرجوني أي أمي بالدنيا أكتر مؤثرة الصورة واضحة نحن مهد الحضارة تاريخنا وتراثنا الشاهد على وجودنا من هيك لبست الثوب الفلسطيني من حفا جنين جبل النار إلى رام الله خليني شوف الكوفية البيضة والحمرة خليني نعليها لفوق بالسما أنا هجاه دية العرب الثاني بخص غزة الثاني بهز هكلي ماتي حر سجل أنا شادية منصور والحطة هويتي من يوم ما خلقت سيدي والشعب مسؤوليتي لك أنا تربيت بين الغرب وبين الشرق بين لغتين بين بخيل بين فقير شفت الحياة من الشقتين سنة مثل الكوفية كيف ما لبستوني وين ما شلحتوني بدلني عأصولي فلسطينية من هيك لبسنا الكوفي لأنها وطنية الكوفي كوفي عربي من هيك لبسنا الكوفي هويتنا الأساسية الكوفي كوفي عربي يلا علي الكوفي علولي هالكوفية الكوفي كوفي عربي علوه هلا بلاد الشام كوفية عربية بتضل عربية عربية من هيك لبسنا الكوفي لأنها وطنية الكوفي كوفي عربي من هيك لبسنا الكوفي هويتنا الأساسية الكوفي كوفي عربي يلا علي الكوفي علولي هالكوفية الكوفي كوفي عربي علوه هلا بلاد الشام كوفية عربية بتضل عربية
Some of y'all think it's a trend, a fashion statement. Disgustingly, I spit on the pavement. It's basic. Y'all know I bang for my flag. My bandana ain't no rag. The kafia ain't no scarf. It's a part of the movement. The symbolism is resistance. No coincidence that you can see the RBG in it. Cable neat the bandera. Ain't it beautiful? I say it in Spanish. It's solidarity. The feelings is mutual. Meanwhile, hide, that's M1 in Arabic. I'm pro-Falastini. Does that mean around your head and ride? Wave it in the air and let me know what side you want. Uhuru. Yeah. The kufi is Arab. Yeah. It's M1 in solidarity. Feel me, Shaja. Dude. From the ghetto to Gaza.
Thank you. Israel's enablers and the United States ramped up their efforts to shut down the growing boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement known as BDS. Many states, including New York, have passed laws against businesses who would boycott Israel as a way of protesting Israel's colonization of the Palestinian people. An anti-boycott bill is currently before the United States Congress. In New York City, Fordham University is attempting to prevent Students for Justice in Palestine, a group that supports the boycott, from forming a campus group. The students brought a lawsuit seeking an injunction against the university to enable them to establish an SJP chapter there. Keith Eldridge, the dean at Fordham University, took the position that SJP was a group that would create polarization on campus and that what they do runs contrary to the mission and values embraced at the university. The students got help from the Center for Constitutional Rights and Palestine Legal. A suit was brought on their behalf in April of last year. 2 weeks ago, a hearing was held in New York's civil court where the students demanded an injunction against Fordham University to permit them to form a chapter. We speak today with Maria LaHood, one of the students' attorneys and the deputy legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Maria LaHood, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
The First Amendment protects free speech and freedom of association, but that right doesn't apply to Fordham University because it's not a state school. The dean of students at Fordham, Keith Eldridge, denied school recognition to the Students for Justice in Palestine on the grounds that it would create polarization that would run contrary to the mission and values embraced at Fordham. How did you counter that argument?
That's what Dean Eldridge first said when he denied SJP approval. Then when CCR and Palestine Legal wrote Fordham and said, you can't do that, you guarantee freedom of expression, the vice president of student affairs responded, well, it was actually because of conduct by other SJPs on other campuses, and that's why we denied this SJP. Then later in the litigation, Eldridge brought up for the first time supposed safety and security concerns, again, based on what other SJPs had purportedly done, but acknowledging that he didn't know if those reports were even true or not. The decision on its at its base was irrational. But even though the First Amendment doesn't apply to Fordham, which is a private Jesuit university, New York has what's called an Article 78 proceeding, which permits you to challenge administrative decisions, whether it's by a government agency, a corporation, or an institution, to ensure that they're complying with their own internal rules and that their decisions are rational. And that's how we brought this case.
The university said that it believes that a student club bearing the name SJP is not in the best interests of our students on either side of the debate and would not serve to foster reasoned discussion of these very difficult issues. What was your response to that?
Well, I mean, obviously it's painfully patronizing, but the United Students Government, which is actually the body that until this decision had always been tasked with approving student clubs, they found the exact opposite. They found that an SJP would actually foster discussion and would be very good for campus debate. We also submitted an affidavit in the case by Ben Lorber, the campus coordinator for JVP, and he said that, you know, he works with SJP and Jewish Voice for Peace groups on campuses all over the United States, and students are grateful for their presence because they actually open debate, they permit discussion of things that weren't discussed before, and that's from students on different sides of the issue.
Fordham said it would grant the club status under a slightly revised version of their constitution that they had proposed, which would include requiring the students to change the name of their club and overtly state its independence, financial and otherwise, from the national SJP. Why did you not accept that offer?
Well, first of all, this offer was never made to the students before Fordham vetoed their club. Second of all, the students had repeatedly stated their independence from both other SJPs on other campuses and National Students for Justice in Palestine. upon the request of the administrators, they actually wrote it into their constitution, saying we're independent. They got written confirmation from NSJP that they're independent. NSJP's website says that they're all autonomous. So there was no confusion as to that fact. But to the main point, the students didn't want a different name. They wanted to be Students for Justice in Palestine. That name connects them to the broader movement for justice for Palestinians. It has a political significance, obviously. And why shouldn't they have the name they want? Why shouldn't they describe themselves as who they are? They are Students for Justice in Palestine.
Fordham said that the group encourages disruptive conduct, and that contradicted the college's values of what they said, quote, civility. Isn't that what Professor Stephen Salida was charged with when he was fired from a tenured position at the University of Illinois, that he was uncivil?
Yeah, that's right. And you know, civility, whether it's civility or whether it's controversy or polarization, as Dean Eldridge said, those are all terms, especially in civility, that have been used really to marginalize groups and to silence groups, whether it's been groups for social justice, whether it's been Native Americans, whether it's been civil rights groups. It's used in order to try to silence. And here it's no different.
What kind of support did the students have? Was the courtroom packed?
Yes, it was amazing. It was, you know, the hearing was on January 3rd, 2 days after New Year's. It was freezing cold out in New York City, and yet the courtroom was overflowing. You know, there were many people who couldn't get in. Estimates were 100 people showed up to support the students. So it was great. The students were thrilled with the turnout to see all that support, to know that people are there for them, because they're basically out there alone.
Well, you haven't gotten a decision yet, but was the demeanor of the judge indicative of something positive?
It was. We were quite pleased. You know, Alan Levine, who's a longtime CCR cooperating counsel, did the argument. The Judge Bannon was receptive. She was engaged. She was very thoughtful. You know, at one point, right from the get-go, she asked, her first question to Alan was, well, can't Fordham sanction the students if they violate the code of conduct at Fordham? You know, and of course they can. I mean, there's no reason to speculate that perhaps there will be some disruptive conduct or there will be something. It made no sense to ban SJP. They can always take measures to enforce their rules afterwards if necessary. And she seemed to acknowledge that. One of the things, you know, although they've said all along, it's the name, SJP. If they change the name, you know, they haven't said it all along. They've said it recently. If they change the name SJP, they can have their club. Later in the argument, they said, and we don't want groups against specific states, and we don't want groups endorsing BDS. So it was clear political motivation. But when Alan said, I doubt that they would have prevented a club against apartheid in South Africa, Judge Bannon made a comment about Northern Ireland. So I think she, you know, expressed some understanding of movements for self-determination against colonial oppression, and that was great.
What would a chapter at Fordham of the SJP do if it got the green light from the judge?
You know, its mission is to build support in the Fordham community for justice and human rights and liberation for Palestinians. So it would do what all clubs do. They would have meetings. They would host educational events. They'd invite speakers. You know, they may have protests and other actions to educate the community, but they would do whatever other student groups do.
There was a student named Safira Lurie last year who organized a rally on campus at Fordham to protest the ban on SJP. What happened to her?
So, yeah, Safira is one of our four petitioners, and she has since graduated from Fordham. After Dean Eldridge denied approval of the group, they were going to hold a protest. So some students talked to Dean Eldridge about the protest. He assigned a student liaison for the protest. He showed up at the rally. And then afterwards, he said that they had violated Fordham rules because they didn't get written approval. Fordham rules don't require written approval for a protest. So he charged Safira. He was holding a hearing, a disciplinary hearing. He was not only the target of the protest because of his decision, he was the complainant because he said they violated the rules. He was also going to be the decision maker about the disciplinary process, for the disciplinary process. So Safira shows up with a lawyer from Palestine Legal and with her professor advisor. Dean Eldridge wouldn't let either of them accompany her. He was going to require the door to be shut with a sound machine on outside the door. And she said, I'm not going to do this. So they didn't have the hearing, and she ended up, you know, getting a warning. But it just shows the lengths to which Fordham will go to sort of stifle their speech.
Is this kind of harassment a national phenomenon? I know that Palestine Legal got 650 complaints between 2014 and 2016. Do you think that this reflects a growing popularity of the Palestine Solidarity Movement?
Absolutely, absolutely. As the movement continues to grow on campus and elsewhere, so does the effort to suppress it. You know you're doing something right when people don't even want you to speak. And you know there's no defense if that's the response.
What are the national implications of the current New York City lawsuit?
Well, I'm not sure if other private universities will be so shameless as to actually prevent an SJP from forming. I mean, there are about 180 groups on campuses across the country that support Palestinian rights. Most of them are Students for Justice in Palestine. But if they do consider that, I hope it will discourage them. But more importantly, I think it shows the courage and the persistence of students, you know, not only in seeking to form an SJP group, but also in bringing a legal challenge to the university to enforce their rights. And it also shows that groups like Palestine Legal and CCR will be there to support them when they do.
Are the members of Students for Justice in Palestine mostly Arab and Muslims?
It's a diverse mix. I think it depends. Again, they're on campuses all over the country. So there are Arab students, Muslim students, there are Jewish students, there are Christian students, there are white students, there are students of color, there are black students. So I think it's really a diverse mix. I mean, if you were to go on something like Canary Mission, which profiles Palestinian rights advocates in order to tarnish their reputations, you might think they're all Arab and Muslim or students of color because that's who they mainly profile. But it really is a diverse mix of students.
Supporters of Palestinian rights have observed sarcastically that there is a Palestine exception to the First Amendment. Is there any truth to this?
Yes, there is. And in fact, that's the title of CCR and Palestine Legal's report, The Palestine Exception to Free Speech. It's not the only exception, but again, when we have people speaking out against power, threatening power, silencing of that speech is often the reaction. It's not popular speech that's usually silenced. It's so-called controversial speech. So I think so.
How do you get a copy of that report?
You can go online, either on Palestine Legal's website or CCR's website, ccrjustice.org or palestinelegal.org.
Can you talk about Kenneth Marcus, who's coming up in the Department of Civil Rights, the kind of forces that are behind him?
Kenneth Marcus founded and is president of the Brandeis Center, which has been quite instrumental in bringing Title VI complaints against universities for essentially for Palestinian rights advocacy on campus, claiming that makes a hostile environment for Jewish students. It's anti-Semitic. All of those complaints have been dismissed, and the Office of Civil Rights has said this is protected free speech, but that hasn't really stopped their efforts to suppress Palestinian rights advocacy on campuses. In fact, the Brandeis Center has also brought a case against the American Studies Association for their boycott of Israeli academic institutions, which is still ongoing. So now Kenneth Marcus is the nominee for Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights of the Department of Education. So he will actually be...
Steinem said is the fox guarding the hen house.
Yes, he will be in charge of enforcing civil rights on U.S. campuses. So, and, you know, he has the misunderstanding at best that that advocacy for Palestinian rights is somehow anti-Semitic when it's a movement that is based in equality. So that's potentially quite frightening.
Yeah, well, they make the equation between Israel and Judaism. And therefore, anything that Israel does that you don't like is therefore anti-Semitic. It's a false equation.
Right. Criticism of a nation state, certainly criticism of a nation state cannot be equated with either criticism of Israelis or, of course, not of Jewish people generally.
I see that the Israeli government has wrote up the list, but it's just recently been released about various organizations in the United States whose leaders and activists are not going to be allowed to go to Israel.
Right.
We're talking about Jewish Voice for Peace, the Quakers.
Yeah.
Ironically, the Quakers were the ones that helped Jewish refugees during the Second World War. I mean, there's a number of groups whose leaders are not going to be allowed to go to Israel. At the same time, Israel is allowing leaders of these right-wing, really fascist organizations in Europe, like from France and from Hungary, to come to Israel.
Right.
What's your thoughts on that?
Well, and just to say, National Students for Justice in Palestine is also one of those six groups from the U.S. that are named. I mean, again, it's just one of the many efforts to try to intimidate people and to suppress criticism of Israel. This affects activists, of course, but it also affects Palestinian students. You know, it can discourage people from getting involved in their SJP clubs if they're worried that they won't be able to go home. You know, we'll see what happens with that. Hopefully it can be challenged, but I encourage people to try to continue to go and visit Palestine for themselves and see what's happening there.
Maria LaHood, you've been counsel on the Olympia food boycott case, which is related to this. Talk about that, please.
So that case, you know, Olympia Food Co-op in Olympia, Washington, was the first business, I think, in the United States to actually boycott Israeli goods. And that was in 2010. The next year, they were threatened with suit if they didn't rescind the boycott. You know, the threat was by a few of the plaintiffs, but there's evidence that Stand With Us, in conjunction with the Israeli government, were actually behind the threat and the loss and the ultimate lawsuit. So the 16 former, they're all former board members now, but the former and current board members at the time were sued for the boycott of Israeli goods. We actually brought CCR brought an anti-SLAPP motion, which is strategic lawsuit against public participation, meaning that the suit was meritless and it was targeting protected speech. We won that. Judgment was that the defendants, who we were representing, would get over $250,000 worth of damages because the case was brought against them. They appealed. We won on appeal. And then they took it to the Washington Supreme Court, and the Washington Supreme Court struck down the anti-SLAPP statute. Yeah. So we were back down before the district judge, our fifth district judge, in fact. We moved to dismiss. We lost. We've been in discovery. And just last month, we moved for summary judgment, hopefully finally putting an end to the case. And we actually included, with the motion for summary judgment, a resolution by the current co-op board, none of whom are defendants, saying this case is not in the best interest of the co-op. This case shouldn't have been brought and it should be dismissed.
You know, these anti-BDS laws are being passed in a number of states, including New York State. And it was shocking to me because I remember boycott movement against apartheid in South Africa. And we just assumed you had a right to free speech, to be able to say to people, I'm not going to do business with them because it's a racist country. But in this instance, they're actually passing laws which allow discrimination against people who would boycott Israel, cutting off finances in New York. What's the prevalence of this? And why are they able to pass this just blatantly illegal kind of legislation?
Yeah, they are unconstitutional. I mean, there are, as of now, I think 23 states, almost half of the states in the United States, have passed some kind of anti-boycott laws dealing with Israel. You know, the American Jewish Committee has actually gotten all 50 governors of the states to sign their petition or pledge to oppose BDS and support Israel. In New York, there's an executive order, but there's also been legislation that they're trying to pass that's even worse than the executive order. Right now, there are cases challenging the legislation in Arizona and in Kansas that have been brought by the ACLU. So I think, hopefully, once these cases are decided, you know, it'll be clear to everyone that these laws are unconstitutional. I mean, there's also federal legislation that's been introduced, you know, the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, which would make supporting a boycott that is fostered by an international government organization like the UN or the EU punishable by exorbitant fines and up to 20 years in prison. I mean, it's really quite something. Hopefully that won't pass, but again, and hopefully it'll be clear soon to all of us, not just many of us, that the laws are unconstitutional.
Yeah, it reminds me of the adage, inasmuch as the United States government supports what Israel is doing, you lay down with dogs and you come up with fleas. Maria, it's a pleasure to be able to speak with you on Law and Disorder. How did you get involved in this kind of litigation?
Well, you know, when I first started on these cases at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I first started at CCR in 2003, and it was actually a couple months after Rachel Corrie had been killed in Gaza, had been run over by a Caterpillar D9 bulldozer driven by an Israeli soldier while she was trying to protect a home from being demolished while the family was inside. And that was in March of 2003. So I started in June of 2003, and on my first day, I actually was researching how can we bring a case against Caterpillar, which we later did, representing Cindy and Craig Corrie, her parents. We brought that in 2005. We also represented five Palestinian families who had been killed or injured when their homes were demolished on top of them. That case was subsequently dismissed after the U.S. government intervened and said, you can't hold Caterpillar liable because we actually pay for the bulldozers being given or being sold to Israel. So that would interfere with our U.S. foreign policy. So that was one of a few cases we brought that year, challenging Israeli war crimes, essentially. And I guess to bring it full circle, Cindy and Craig Corrie were actually at the Fordham hearing recently.
Oh,
so
no
that
kidding.
Was,
I
yeah,
didn't know
no,
that,
that
yeah.
was great. And I mentioned the Olympia Food Co-op case. Rachel and the Corries are from Olympia, and so that's, you know, it's all connected.
Yeah. And Michael Ratner was at the center when you brought that case.
Absolutely.
It adhered to one of his rules, which is don't be afraid to take a case even if you think you might lose it.
Yeah.
And just get a lot of publicity on the case and try to do some good.
Right. But, you know, these were cases, I think, if they were anywhere else besides Israel, we wouldn't have lost. You know, they're solid cases that should have been won had the courts been ready. And I think one of the things that I think is so important about supporting the Palestinian rights movement, it's about raising awareness and opening that space so that these conversations can happen and that justice for Palestine can actually be done eventually.
Maria LaHood, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
This divestment bill hurts my feelings. That Caterpillar bulldozer ended life in the body of an American citizen, drove her bones into the ground while a company cashed in on the sale. The claws of D9 bulldozers unearthed the livelihood of occupied Palestinians, uprooting their graveyards to make way for illegal settlements. But we need a positive campus climate. While HP stock rises on division, producing technology to segregate Palestinians, biometric IDs at checkpoints, enhancing the naval blockade of an open-air prison, Palestinians on campus listen to words like positive, climate, hurt feelings, knowing their tuition invests in companies raining terror on loved ones, that suffering, like their voices, is non-existent to student board members looking for cushy jobs at top five law firms. But this divestment bill, it's divisive. The Montgomery bus boycott, divisive. The Great Boycott, one-sided. Abolishing slavery, radical. Nelson Mandela, a terrorist. Indigenous, savages, women's suffrage, complicated. Desegregation, provocative. Hiroshima security, internment camps a necessity. Bantustan's autonomy, Iraq liberation, Palestine burn. There is always, always going to be an excuse. Catchphrases, talking points, strip away names and faces. We are being militant, unreasonable. There's context to this oppression. The word apartheid, it makes you feel uncomfortable. It's apartheid by definition. FITSA 73 convention. By law, it is a crime against humanity. Two sets of laws for two people. Labor, land ownership, access to education. 50 laws of discrimination. 46 years of occupation. 27,000 homes demolished. Nearly a million arrested since 67. Whoa, whoa, every nation has problems. But why the singling out on campuses? You mean like Darfur? Tibet? South Africa, sweatshops, Coca-Cola, animal testing, the Keystone Pipeline, undocumented rights, the prison industrial complex, fossil fuels, teacher unions, university cuts, and bottled water? The real question, Why are you singling out any injustice for protection? Let me get the next one for you. Israel is democratic. Democratic like coal is clean, Miller Lite is the same great taste less filling, and McDonald's salads are healthy. These are not imagined scenarios. Our tuition dollars are profiting off of death. Divestment is the next step. This is not about a nation or a people, but what's being done to people in our names, with our currency. This university will not liberate anyone, but it can choose to cease making a buck off of misery. Vote yes for divestment. No to appeasement. Affirming injustice isn't positive for any climate.
And with that, we are going to go straight to the New York for Palestinian Coalition rally at Grand Central Station. It was both great fun to see how people commanded the space, took over the environment towards the end of supporting the Palestinian people, and with a specific emphasis on the issue of youth who were arrested, and that is Ahed Tamimi, a 16-year-old who has been arrested, is being held by the Israeli Defense Forces, and we want her released now. So let's go to Grand Central Station.
From Palestine to Mexico!
From Palestine to Mexico!
All the walls have got to go!
All the walls have got to go!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Ahed Tamimi!
Free, free Ahed Tamimi!
We are gathered here today to demand the release of Palestinian child activist Ahed Tamimi from Israeli Zionist dungeon! Ahed Tamimi is a 16-year-old Palestinian girl from the village of Nabi Saleh, a village known for resisting increasing Israeli encroachment on their land. Ever since she was a child, she had to face Israeli soldiers coming onto her land, taking her father, imprisoning her father, imprisoning her family members, harassing them, beating them, shooting them. You know, before Ahed was actually taken by Israel, and because of the slap heard around the world, people don't know that the reason she slapped him is because right before that, they shot her 14-year-old cousin in the face and put him in a medically induced coma for his injuries. That's the background of that slap. It didn't come from nowhere.
Amen.
It came from a place of resistance.
Amen.
When Israeli soldiers came onto her land and shot her family members.
Amen.
And then tried to enter her home. This is not assault. This is self-defense. The same type of self-defense that Palestinians have been engaging in ever since 1948, when their land was illegally stolen by Israel. The Tamimi family is being severely targeted now because they are a symbol of resistance. Because they continue to stand up in the face of Israeli oppression, even when they've been oppressed and subjugated time and time again. Ahed Tamimi's father is also an activist, and he actually spent 3 years in Israeli jails without trial, without even a charge, in administrative detention, because they can do that. Now, they're trying to scapegoat our children, our people, our communities. But if someone were to come to your home, take your father and throw him in jail, and shoot your 14-year-old cousin in the face, and consistently target your family, and this is all you've seen growing up, what would you do? What kind of person wouldn't resist this? Wouldn't stand up to this unfair treatment? Ahed Tamimi's case is not an isolated case. Israel regularly targets, harasses, and abuses Palestinian children, especially when they are part of the resistance, because they want to crush their morale and spirit from a young age. And they want to send a message to the rest of Palestinian society, telling them, do not participate in similar things. Do not stand up for your family. Do not stand up for your land. because if you do, we'll throw you in jail just like we did to her. But are we going to let them do that?
No!
Are we going to let them do that?
No!
Every single time they so much as touch a hair on the head of one of our children, we need to be out here making the loudest possible noise that we can. We need to let Israel know that people are watching, that people won't stand for it. And that's why we're here today, to not only condemn Israel's atrocities against the Palestinian people and Ahed Tamimi, but stand for resistance in all aspects of Palestinian society in whatever shape or form it takes.
Amen.
We're also here to educate you, because there's a lot of misinformation going about this case, and if enough people knew what was going on with Ahed Tamimi, this crowd would be all of Grand Central Terminal. Every single person would join with us, because any person that knows the truth about the Palestinian struggle stands on the right side of history. Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Ahed Tamimi!
Free, free Ahed Tamimi!
Free, free Ahed Tamimi!
Free, free Ahed Tamimi!
We will be reading out 10 facts about the Tamimi case to educate you in this rally here, so that we are able to take what we learn outside of the noise that we make today and make sure that everyone we know, everyone that's in our life, knows about Ahed Tamimi's case. Because we can't rest and we can't stop putting pressure on Israel until they release her and until they think twice about touching one of our children ever again.
From New York to Palestine!
From New York to Palestine!
Jailing Ahed is a crime!
Jailing Ahed is a crime!
From New York to Palestine!
From New York to Palestine!
And that's what we intend to do, free Ahed Tamimi and her cousin, Nariman Tamimi, and all of the child prisoners being held by the Israeli Defense Forces in occupied Palestine. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Thirsty City, a monthly beat and rap night at The Know in Portland. On Saturday, January 27th, Thirsty City hosts the launch party for their new label and cassette release featuring 29 beat instrumentalists from Portland and Munich. The release party also features live sets by Bry Zen, Two North, and more. Again, that's Thirsty City at The Know, 3728 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
February 13th, 1983, KBOO Community Radio held an open house to celebrate moving into a building that we could come to own here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Join us Tuesday, February 13th for the 35th anniversary of the open house moving-in party. Food, drinks, tours, and memories will be on hand as we celebrate 35 years in this building and 50 years of KBOO. That's the 35th anniversary open house, Tuesday, February 13th, 5 to 8 p.m., here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland. More information can be found at 50yearsofkboo.fm.
And this is indeed KBOO Portland. It's 10 o'clock in the a.m. It's Friday, and that means it's time for Valley Views. This week is part two of practical and affordable energy-saving techniques that will help reduce your carbon footprint. And as usual, we will finish out the hour with flashpoints from KPFA in Berkeley.